This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson coming at you from Aotea, Great Barrier Island, New Zealand. We've got Fiona McLean with us today. She's doing some awesome work in the spirit of Rachel Carson. Fiona, thanks for joining us.
It's fine. I'm pleased to join you.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how you and I came to be in touch with each other.
Okay. Well, I'm a medical practitioner. I'm a medical doctor, and I qualified as a doctor back in 1980 at the University of Otago in Dunedin in the South Island. But then I moved north and worked for most of the last 30 years at the University of Auckland, and also working at the Auckland Hospital. And my specialty area is rheumatology, which is arthritis, looking into the causes of arthritis. And I've been involved in clinical work and in medical research for much of that time. And then in the last 3 years, I've made a move for sort of lifestyle reasons. My husband and I moved to a very beautiful area in the South Island, near Queenstown, and I go down to work down in the bottom of the South Island at Q Hospital in Invercargill as a rheumatologist, so I do outpatient clinics there, and I'm developing an association with the University of Otago again, you know, for some academic work which I do there. So my background that brought me to the 1080 question is largely as a medical scientist, because that does allow me, even though I'm not an animal scientist, I'm a human scientist, but obviously there are a lot of overlaps. We are animals. And I realized that I have the ability to read the literature that is in the ecology, you know, that has been assembled in the science of ecology in New Zealand over the last 50 years to do with 1080. Now, the reason I got interested in 1080 was because my husband and various friends have always been very keen hunters and trampers, and indeed I'm a very keen tramper. And I heard this very disturbing story about 4 years ago now, that this group of men were in a remote part of Fiordland, and this was a part that they subsequently learned had 1080 dropped all over it. They didn't know that when they first arrived because they came to that area through a very remote sort of track. And what they found was very disturbing. There were carcasses of deer lying on the ground with foam, well, looking as though they had died a horrible death. You know, the ground was all not smooth. It had been, the hooves had been raking around. And there were also dead wood pigeons on the ground. And other small birds. And I thought that this really sounded terrible. They discovered that that area had a 1080 poison drop on it only a few weeks before. But they didn't discover that until they walked out another way.
Yes.
I mean, because this area is very remote.
Yes, it was like the aftermath of a Holocaust.
Yeah, and basically what they noticed when they were there, as well as these dead animals on the ground, was an absolute absence of birdsong.
Yes.
And they had been in that area a year or so before, a little bit further over by Lake Wilmot, which is one of the very remote lakes down there. And, you know, the birdsong had apparently been so loud they could hardly hear themselves talk.
Yes, yes.
So this was another thing that made me feel disturbed, because the story the New Zealand public has been given about 1080 is that it will bring back the birdsong. So from that point, I decided, well, I actually do have the ability to read the original papers. You know, I don't just have to go by what Doc says on the website. I can go back through the university library, get the original papers out and read them.
Yes.
And I also, during my research process, came across some other people who had also done that. And these, there's a couple called the Whiting O'Keefes.
Yes, from Caltech.
Who live on Coromandel. And Quinn Whiting O'Keefe, through an extraordinary coincidence, is also a rheumatologist.
For real?
But I didn't know him before this whole business, and I still don't know him. But we have corresponded briefly But he and his wife are American citizens originally. They've now been in New Zealand, I think, for quite a long time. But he used to hold a post in the States in an academic institution, and he was very expert in analyzing the quality of science.
Yes,
behind,
at
know,
the he was at Cal things. At Caltech.
And this is actually quite an important topic.
Yes.
I don't know if any of your listeners will have read Bad Science or Bad Pharma. These are books written, I can't remember the author now, Goldring. Anyway, they are fantastic books, and they're all about how science can be used to pull the wool over people's eyes. Badly done science.
How about this? I saw an article last year where the editor of Lancet, which is the Journal of the American Medical Association, the editor of that came out and said point blank, he believed that as much as 50% of all the scientific research published in the journals was fake or bogus or just of inferior quality.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, people sort of hear that and they think, oh, scientists are making it all up. But of course, that's never the case. You know, scientists generally do their work with the best intentions. But the trouble is, particularly in the biological sciences, it's very difficult to do really watertight studies. You know, you have to have a very large number of patients or birds or whatever you're studying. You have to have a very good placebo group who hopefully are having exactly the same experience as the test group, except that they're not having, in this case, 1080. And then you have to have very rigorous statistical methods so that you can make sure that the finding you find is true and really holds water.
Absolutely. That in itself is a very important thing for people to know about. Would you say that
important
observations to me was that he observed that in the world of today, we're all intimately involved with very high levels of technology that's made possible by very advanced science, but almost nobody has even the most rudimentary scientific knowledge to understand what that technology is and how it might affect us.
Yes, that's quite true. And the other thing I think that people need to realize is that there is a distinction between the non-life sciences and the life sciences. So, you know, if you're proving something in physics using maths, or, you know, you're making technology that we use in computers and so on, that type of science is really very different to the science of living systems. The same techniques can be used, but you must analyze the data with a high degree of critical thinking,
yes,
especially in the life sciences, because there are so many variables in living systems that cannot necessarily be controlled for.
Absolutely, and this is a very important point. This goes back to René Descartes, who had the idea that animals and living beings were machines, and that made it a lot easier to deal with scientifically, but the opposite is the case. A living being is so complex with holistic...
And the other thing is that those living beings are within a living biosphere.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and this is something that the 1080 literature, much of it has kind of skirted around or ignored, or it was done in the sort of 70s and 80s. So the understanding of how the ecosystem works, and I'm, of course, not an ecologist, but I have read quite a lot around this now, has evolved so that people know a bit more now than they did, and they also know about this whole area of what's called invasion biology.
Yes.
So this is a new science that's only just emerging now.
Yes.
It's very important, especially for New Zealand.
I cannot tell you how cool it is to talk with you, because you've touched on several different things already that I'd really like to explore in greater detail. But look, let me ask you this. I didn't know that you were a medical doctor, but as I understand it, the reason that 1080, let me just clarify something for people that may not be aware. 1080 is a very deadly pesticide developed, I think, before World War II in Europe, and its use has been banned even in the United States since, I think you said, 1980, as I understand it, it was banned because of its threat to human health.
Well, yeah, there were three reasons from my reading that the Environmental Protection Authority banned it. One was that there is no antidote. So if a human being is poisoned with N80, they will generally die if they have had the, you know, sufficient dose.
Which is how much? 100 milligrams?
Well, in humans, the LD50, so that's the amount that
kills half the people.
50 people out of a group of 100.
Yes.
So it's a sort of average one.
Yes.
Is 2 milligrams per kilogram.
Really? That little?
Yeah.
Oh, per kilogram.
For a 70 kilogram man, that would be 140 milligrams.
Okay.
It's similar to the degree of poisonousness of cyanide on a milligram per kilogram basis.
Okay.
Although, of course, it's quite a different poison to cyanide.
Yes.
Now, the 2 milligram per kilogram dose is the LD50, but there's another dose that's lower than that called the minimum lethal dose.
Yes.
And that's less. So that's if you're a, you know, susceptible individual.
Yes.
And that is 0.7 milligrams per kilogram.
And you touched on another important point there that applies not only with chemical toxicity, but with microwaves and radionuclides, is that every individual person is going to have a different response to these things.
Exactly. Exactly. And also that individual people have a different weight. So if you've got a toddler wandering around on the Rootburn track, for example, which has 1080 dropped all over it, usually in the winter outside the time of the tourists, but, you know, there are still pallets lying around, although they're carefully swept off the track by dock workers. That toddler, who might be only 15 kilograms or 20 kilograms, is only going to need to eat 1 to 2 pellets, maybe 2 pellets, but maybe only one if they're a light child who's susceptible, for a fatal dose.
Yes, absolutely.
It's really very frightening. But anyway, just to get back to the EPA reasons why it was banned in the US.
Yes.
So it was one of them.
Yes.
Another one was Bikill. And this is the big worry in New Zealand.
Yes.
So Bikill means that it's not just killing the rodents, so obviously rats and mice, well, no, rats are very susceptible to 1080, but it also kills native birds most definitely, and many New Zealanders do not realise that, but
no.
There's absolutely no doubt in the literature that it kills native birds.
Yes.
It also kills other things, like the cows that we saw on TV1 not so long ago.
Yes. Well,
and deer, which die a horrible, gruesome death.
Well, this is a good point to just mention. We won't go into too much technicality, but it disrupts the Krebs cycle, right? And the Krebs cycle is the way that all your is what mitochondria use to generate the energy. And even the smallest life forms, invertebrates, have mitochondria. Yes. Plants don't have mitochondria, but I think everything in the animal kingdom has mitochondria.
And, pretty much.
And the 1080 disrupts this cycle. And so they die a very prolonged agonizing
death over, often over 3 days.
But there's
no... You know, there are reports of, you know, animals trying to tear out their own stomachs.
Yes.
Of the
oh, my God.
Of pain. Mm. And you're foaming around the mouth. Dogs go absolutely insane.
Yes.
Dogs are particularly susceptible.
Yes. It's well, you know what, Clyde, well, no, but go, but please continue.
Well, I was just going to go to the third point.
Yes.
So Bikill is the second point, and the third point is that the Americans in 1985 realized that there were deaths in endangered species because of 1080.
Yes.
And that was another reason why it was banned. And this is something that needs to be discussed, because one of the dock platforms, in terms of their argument, which is very pro-1080, is that, oh, they have mammals in the US, but we don't have mammals here, so our birds are not so susceptible. Now, you need to look at that carefully.
Exactly.
One of the animals that probably still is or was endangered was the American eagle, which is, of course, a bird.
Yes.
But that was one of the animals that the US was worried about as an endangered species. And birds are susceptible to 1080, not as much as animals. Mammals. Their LD50s are often around about 5 to 8 milligrams per kilogram. But you need to remember that they're very much smaller.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, you can still kill them very easily with 1080.
Yes.
Because they have such a small body size. So one way of remembering this that I think is illustrative is if you're in Fiordland, let's imagine you're a little bird, a little 10-gram tomtit, and 1080 pellets are coming out of the sky, and one falls in a puddle that's the size of a breakfast teacup, okay, 250 mils. That pellet will completely dissolve because it's very soluble in water.
Yes.
If that bird takes a half a teaspoon, it will die.
Yes.
So, you know, you need to be aware. This doc comes out with this information that is partially true, but you need to know more. And that's what I think there is a high degree of ignorance around this chemical and its effects.
This is so important, your perspective on all this, and I cannot thank you enough for sharing this with me. And it's opening up a lot because there's not many people. Even Clyde Graff, as big of an activist as he is still, he'll tell you himself he's not that much knowledgeable about the more sort of technical stuff like we're talking about now. But, you know, one of the big omissions of the DOC propaganda is that we are mammals that are susceptible to 1080.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, may I mention three important aspects of the whole pesticide, but what Rachel Carson called biocides, substances that kill everything. You've got bioaccumulation, you've got sublethal doses, and you've got secondary poisoning. And what you've talked about just sort of covers all of those things. But it's like some people think that if it doesn't kill you, then you're okay.
Yeah, well, there's a big long. As a doctor, I know all about that. You know, there's a we deal with sick people usually rather than dead people.
Yes.
So there's a lot of nastiness that goes in between a small dose and a lethal dose, and very little is known about that in human beings. But I've covered some of that in one of the chapters of my book.
Yes.
There are reports of sublethal poisoning with 1080 in humans, but very few, remarkably few.
Yes.
And I feel that there must be more.
Exactly, because we aren't looking for the right thing, or it's being marginalized. But, you know, like, for example, we've got we all have sort of like a burden of toxicity in our bodies, including synthetic radionuclides from the dawn of the nuclear age, strontium-90 that your body thinks is calcium. Yeah, and all different kinds of stuff. We all have this, and I think that if they were able to test. If legitimate testing was carried out at the level of sufficient sensitivity, that 1080 or its residual compounds might show up in a lot of places.
Well, it's possible. I mean, the other thing, even more sort of directly, is how many deer, for example, are running around in Fiordland with sublethal toxicity and 1080 sitting in their muscles.
Yes, absolutely. Well,
and how often are deer hunters, and, you know, these are in my family,
yes.
How often are they becoming partially poisoned by 1080 and just thinking they've got a bit of the flu or
absolutely
or muscles or what, you know, what's going on?
Well, now tell us, isn't it believed that Alzheimer's disease is in part brought on by an accumulation of heavy metals, including aluminium, in the people's nervous system. Is that accurate?
Well, I don't want to get into that if you don't mind, Jeff.
Okay,
that's a different area.
But it's an example.
Controversial.
Yes.
I don't know about the aluminium. I certainly know that there's anxiety. Not just for Alzheimer's, but for Parkinson's and all sorts of neurodegenerative diseases, that there could be a link with heavy metals. But you know, I haven't gone into the detail of the science there, and I'm not a neurologist, so okay. I'd rather not sort of trespass across.
Well,
there.
No, but that's okay. I can edit this out, but I was just trying to use an example of the accumulation of substances in our bodies that don't belong. You know, like
it certainly can. See, one of the things that worries me with the sublethal toxicity. Let's take the example of trout. Okay.
Yes.
Now, New Zealand was stocked with beautiful rainbow trout, I think from California, 100 or so years ago, and our lovely rivers in the South Island were great for these trout, and that's become a huge sporting industry, and people from the States and all around the world come here for trout fishing. But it has been shown that trout accumulate 1080 in their muscle, and they can be swimming around in the river and have significant quantities of 1080 in them and not die. Now, maybe that's good for the trout, but that's not so good for the trout fisherman or woman who eats that trout on the riverbank, you know?
Absolutely.
And there have been studies. There's a study that I talk about in my book done by this group called the Cawthron Institute, where they gave trout deliberately a dose of 1080 that was felt to be equivalent to, I think, 30 poisoned mice. Now, if you're a trout fisherman, you'll know that when... that trout can eat mice and do eat mice.
Really?
And they can, you know, be little poison packets that accumulate in the flesh of the trout. And trout live for a long time, years and years and years. So, you know, there are game animals, trout, deer, potentially pigs, that are running around in New Zealand that are being hunted and eaten without much knowledge of how much 1080 is actually in them. And I think there could well be instances where there is significant amount.
Yes, I'm sure. Now, let me ask you another sort of technical thing that I've been making this connection for several years, and I've been wanting to run this by you. In looking into 1080, I noticed that it's the central most active atom is an atom of the element fluorine, which is a member of, it's the most active, the most reactive of all the elements, and it's in the halogen family along with iodine, bromine, and chlorine. And a 1080 molecule is 24.5% fluorine by molecular weight. So, for example, if New Zealand has deployed 200,000 kilograms of 1080, which is probably a lot less than they've actually deployed, but that means about a fourth of that, or 50,000 kilograms of fluorine, are in the environment somewhere. And so it's another one of the myths of the propaganda is that the 1080 magically breaks down. And they've even had an advert with a rugby player saying that it breaks down into salt and vinegar.
But that's complete rubbish.
It is, but it's regardless of its...
Fluorine, I don't know how much of a risk that is. I can't, you know, give you any kind of intelligent answer about that.
Yes.
In Australia, there are plants, like a plant called the poison pea plant, that contains sodium fluoroacetate in it.
Yes.
And gastrolobium something, I think it's called. But anyway, it's a poison pea plant. It's in Western Australia. And those plants have very high quantities of potassium fluoroacetate in them. And so, you know, those plants are in the environment. If the fluoride is, well, fluorine is a big problem, you would expect it to be a problem there.
Well, but that's in the plant. That's naturally occurring
that's in the
fluorine.
But the plant breaks down, you know. Yes. So the plant can break down into the soil and so on. I'm not sure if the fluorine is a potential problem or not, but I can certainly tell you that 1080, when it's dropped in a pellet, and especially if it lands on a dry ground or in snow, place where it's very cold, the bacteria that normally break down the 1080 will not work very well. And those pellets can retain activity for as much as 6 months.
Wow.
You know, long time. If they're rained on, that will reduce more quickly, and sometimes it's only a few weeks or a week. But there are circumstances where those pellets can remain active and still have the ability to poison things for months and months.
This is a very important point. And this is a distinction between 1080 that's dispersed into the environment, but it's not ingested by an organism, versus the 1080 that is. Then it becomes metabolized in different ways.
Yeah. So, it certainly can still exist on the ground in the pellet form sometimes, and it's quite hard to predict whether it will be there or not, whether the active ingredient will still be active or not.
Yes.
But then if it is eaten by something like, let's say, a possum, and then the possum dies, it certainly has been shown, and there's studies in the ecology literature to show this, that it's active inside the possum for, again, months and months,
and then
which is why when 1080 has been used in Australia, they make a big deal over there that any animal that's died with 1080 needs to be buried sort of 3 meters down or something, you know, that's part of their protocol.
Yes, as opposed to leaving a whole forest full of dead carcasses laying there for months.
Yeah, so those are just full of 1080, those dead carcasses, and can easily poison birds like kea and moorpork and things that feed on carcasses or, you know, whatever is around. They are ongoing sources of poisoning.
Well, and then the thing, then when those die, whatever eats that, it might still have it too, and just on and on down the line. It's like saturating the whole biosphere.
Yeah, I mean, the term bioaccumulation is a bit confusing.
Yes.
Because that was originally used for poisons like DDT. And DDT does accumulate in the food chain to a much greater degree than 1080 does.
Yes.
You know, and so the word bioaccumulation has been particularly tagged onto DDT. And when people say, oh, 1080 doesn't bioaccumulate, they're really sort of looking at it in comparison with DDT. So it's not as bad as DDT, but it certainly still accumulates in the food chain in the way we've been mentioning, especially in animals that are lying on the ground and have been poisoned. They
yes.
are a source of further poisoning.
And you can have... You can have metabolic byproducts that are themselves may not be 1080, but they're not a nutrient either.
Yeah, so you know it's dangerous stuff. We put it out, we expect it's all gone as a heavy rain and it's disappeared. Well, that's not the case.
No. Well, look, let's talk about some of the blatant propaganda techniques that DOC is clearly using.
Yeah, I wrote this book and spent all the time sort of researching it. And then since I've had the book published, I've found that very distressing as a sort of a patriotic New Zealand citizen to find that it's not a level playing field. People have, you know, there has been a degree of people trying to suppress a publication of the fact that my book is out. The news media seem to be so incredibly biased.
Oh my God, I couldn't believe when I saw you on TV One. I go like, look, they it's like they're bringing you on there as just a token little form of entertainment to just they can say, oh look, we're showing both sides of it. We're unbiased.
Yes. Well, I mean, I was very surprised that they actually put me on TV One because hardly anybody gets any news media coverage at all.
Exactly.
It's pro 1080. Group. And I think that was only because of the hickory. And I admire those people for taking that stand and walking, you know, from Bluff to Wellington and from Cape Reinga down to Wellington and holding placards and saying, look, it's not all right with us.
Yes.
But that was hardly covered in the media, that hickory, except to be very critical of the group as a whole.
Well, it was funny on the didn't surprise me, but in when they had you on TV One, when it was showing the DOC guys that were out walking in the quote unquote well manicured forest, the guy goes like, so I've been getting all these death threats from these like anti 1080 people, and they go like, so do you fear for your life? And he goes like, well, yes, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't. And I just went like, oh
well,
my God, what a crock of bullshit!
You know, it's a smear campaign,
exactly.
A deliberate smear campaign,
absolutely,
to make people who are anti 1080 look as though they're fools and they're violent and they're sort of feral, you know,
nutters. Nutters. And so, but yeah, I reckon that all of that was just completely staged. I think that that they went in there the day before and trimmed off all that vegetation themselves.
Well, I mean, you've got to be careful just when you say that sort of thing, because there is no doubt that the pests, the introduced pests, like, and particularly deer and possums, do change the ecosystem in the forest and damage it.
Yes.
But the answer is not 1080. You know, no. For years and years, people have been culling deer here around the Lakes District in the South Island and Fiordland using helicopters. And I don't much like the idea of a whole lot of deer being shot, but often that is necessary to keep the population at a level that the forest is not too much damaged.
Yes.
And that venison, if it's not been poisoned, can be sold to markets in Europe, and Germany takes quite a lot to make salami and all this sort of thing.
Yes.
You know, it's an industry that's been going on for a long time, but it's under threat now because they can't take deer from the areas that have been 1080'd for at least 4 to 6 months.
Economic repercussions.
Yeah. And the same with the possum fur industry, you know, which is possum fur and possum merino. I don't know if you've got any jerseys of that, but it's really amazing material, very, very light and very warm. And possums have been plucked, and there's a whole industry along that line, and we've got masses of possums in the bush. But again, if they've been poisoned, they can't be used for that purpose.
Yes.
So, you know, again, that's a really crazy thing, as far as I can see,
yes,
for the government to be doing.
Let me just, the reason I brought that up about that the manicuring might have been done by people is, Clyde Graff especially has evidence of, I think even in his film Poisoning Paradise, he shows that there was an incidence on the South Island where there was all these trees that had been, the leaves had been eaten, and DOC was saying that it was possums, but a friend of his or somebody that lives there actually had film, 16 millimeter film of cows. It was actually, it had been eaten by cows, but DOC was going like, oh no, this was, we want this to be possums that did this, because it, here on Great Barrier, there's an island called Rakitu, or they call it Arid Island, and they did a poison drop a few weeks ago of Brodificum, which we can also talk about later. It's an iodine-based anticoagulant poison. But yes, but DOC told the one family that lives on the island that had been successfully trapping the rats, said there weren't that many, but DOC insisted that they stop their trapping because it was going to interfere with their poisoning campaign.
Yeah, yeah.
What sense does that make?
I mean, it's awful. The whole thing is awful. I do think that Doc have engaged in some very suspect activities, but I'm not. I don't want to be viewed as a conspiracy theorist.
Well, but do you know what that word really means? It's Latin root. The word,
sorry?
The word conspiracy, it's Latin root. It comes from the word conspirare, that means to breathe together.
Oh, yeah.
So we're all co-conspirators. Everyone who breathes is a co-conspirator. Yeah. But I think that there's a lot of truth to it, I think.
I think that you've got a whole industry now, you know, a big industry, and people who are caught up in that industry because that's their job,
yes,
feel that they have to support the dock line. And of course it's now the government line, so
yes,
they've got huge amounts of reason to support that, and individual people are going to be in a bind, because if their job and their income depends upon them towing the party line, then very few people will step outside that and say, no, it's wrong.
Absolutely. It's just like a soldier turning on the nerve gas to kill the people in the concentration camp because it was their job. They were just following orders. But you know what?
You know, they've got a lot invested in it. And if everybody else is doing the same thing, then, you know, why would you stick your head above the parapet?
Exactly.
You know, you'll get shot.
Exactly.
You'll lose your job. You'll be ostracized.
Absolutely. Well, look, let me ask you this. I mentioned in an email, if you had heard of this, he was a psychologist at Stanford University.
Oh, yes, Milgram. But that
relates.
Very interesting experience.
It definitely relates to people's unquestioning trust of authority figures, and how that they'll even do what they think was going to kill someone just because the guy in the lab coat told them to.
That is exactly right. And I think you're very correct in bringing that up with regard to the whole 1080 issue. But my point really that I'm trying to get across to people is that the guys in the lab coats, you know, you've got to look carefully at who they are and what they are saying. Because the actual scientists, if you read the actual papers, much of the time they have not come to the same conclusions as Doc have with regard to their particular paper. You know, they will have said, well, the findings suggest, or, you know, this study needs to be repeated in a larger group, or they'll say there's flaws in our study because there's not an adequate placebo, but, you know, you could draw these various conclusions. Whereas the sort of hype that comes out with the PR machine, once the PR machine's got off that piece of, you know, that paper from the literature, is to say, oh, this proves it. This proves it.
Absolutely.
But that's not true.
No.
It's not true.
It oversimplifies. It's related to the whole mentality that revolves around people think that they're being informed by a 30-second soundbite coming from mass media, which is not there to provide accurate information. It's a business that's designed to make money for its stockholders. People don't understand that. The whole thing absolutely
has sort of boiled down to this horrible business model, and at the bottom of the whole thing are these poor, particularly birds, but also insects. And actually, that's, I'll have to go soon, but the insects we need to talk about, because this is a great area that has been almost very understudied. 1080 is an insecticide. That's been shown in old studies, and whether or not it kills insects in New Zealand has been debated. But I've looked at the literature that Doc pushes forward as being proof that it doesn't kill insects, and I don't believe that those are good studies at all. And I, as I say, I've talked about this in my book quite a lot. So my real concern, not just about the birds, but about the insects, because the insects underpin the whole ecosystem. And if you're killing off all the insects, then you're going to kill the forest.
Absolutely. The insects are there's so many of them, and they're so important.
Right.
Well, look, let me ask you this. I hear the expression a humane poison. Now, isn't that a bit Orwellian?
That is terribly Orwellian, yeah. I mean, the level of humanity of a poison has been graded as 0 to 8. And I think cyanide, which I mentioned before, I think it's relatively humane, supposed to be relatively humane, and that's because it works almost instantaneously. And we know that because, for example, if you put cyanide out for possums, you'll find the possums all dead around the actual pot of cyanide. You know, they've hardly been able to move, whereas 1080, they've all disappeared because they can move. It's been graded as 6 out of 8 on the humaneness spectrum. And 8 is the worst, least humane. So even on that spectrum, which is made up by all sorts of pseudoscience, in my view, you know, 1080 does not come out as humane. You know, it's 6 out of 8 on a scale where 8 is the worst, least humane.
Yes.
But it's not, you know, even so, if you look into how that scale is graded, it's pseudoscience. It really is. It's just trying to understand how an animal suffers when we don't really know. And there's all huge evidence that animals do suffer horribly.
Absolutely. Well, who are we? Humans are so arrogant in our anthropocentrism that we think we're the only ones with intelligence, the only ones with thoughts and feelings, the only ones who matter on this planet.
True.
But every other being has its own unique spirit and consciousness, because they're living beings. They're not Cartesian machines. They're fellow beings,
right.
We're supposed to, as I see it, our true nature as people, we're supposed to be the guardians and the caretakers, or the kaitiakis of our family of life, not the murderers and the destroyers.
I know.
And it's just
the whole thing. You know, it can become quite overwhelming. It's such a terrible miscarriage of justice, if you like.
Absolutely.
Well, anyway, I will have to go in a minute, Jeff. Have we got anything else you'd like to sort of go on to, just a last couple of questions?
Yes, well, talking about sort of short-term solutions to the problem we're talking about. Clyde Graff reckons that a lot of these forests, if we just simply just didn't do anything, just leave it like it is, that the possums and the stoats and the weasels and everybody can sort of live together in harmony. And then there's also the thing of whenever, if a bunch of rats do get killed off, they come back with a vengeance because they might have developed a resistance, or they breed even more to sort of make up for it. But life is basically very resilient. It doesn't want to be killed.
Yeah, I agree with him. And in medicine, there is this sort of do no harm philosophy is well known. And, you know, you can sit, the ecology literature has looked at this whole question of whether the pests keep each other under control. So if you think of four species, so we've got rats, stoats, mice, and possums. There are some interesting experiments whereby, for example, just the possums have been taken out of an area of land where they've been studied. And what that shows is that the rats proliferate enormously when the possums are not there. Now, this is a bit surprising because possums are not carnivores. They don't eat the rats. But what they do is compete with the rats for a food source.
Yes.
So the competitive release hypothesis is something that's been written about in the New Zealand Journal of Ecology, and it's fully a sort of well-known hypothesis, and it's to do with the fact that these animals keep each other in check. So another example is that if you take the rats out, then the stoats can change from eating rats, because stoats love eating rats, that's one of their main foods. The stoats will prey switch and start eating birds. So, you know, if you upset the apple cart with 1080, you're actually going to make the whole problem with pests worse. You're going to blast an area and kill off everything, and then the rats are going to repopulate, and they can repopulate incredibly quickly. They're going to be new, vibrant, active young rats that will be very good at eating birds. Then you're going to have a whole lot of rats there. Then you're going to have a whole lot of stoats, because the stoats will come in to eat the rats. And, you know, the whole ecosystem is unbalanced. And the final common pathway is that the birds will die and be reduced in numbers.
Yes, it's like
so
every.
You're actually going to make a terrible mess by trying to fix things.
Every 1080 drop site is like a miniature version of an asteroid impact, and then everything's going to be trying to come back and fill different niches and stuff like that. But let me.
Exactly.
But what about you touched on a much bigger problem that humanity has done. So many things throughout what I think is the history of what we call civilization. For several thousand years, that's really when we started to go wrong. We were no longer indigenous people living simply and close to the earth. We were living in cities with militaries and industry and digging precious things from the land. But when we've disrupted, we've done all these things, like just bringing the possums to New Zealand is just one of probably millions of examples that can come under. It's a form of invasion. But then the things we do to try to correct it, invariably, all that does is just make things worse.
Yeah, I think that the, you know, standing back and take a very holistic view, we need to be more aware of our place in the ecosystem and how it is much greater than we are. You know, especially the natural ecosystem in New Zealand, which is so precious and so undamaged, or at least it was. We are all connected, you know, and we have lost that knowledge by so many people just buying their food from the supermarket and, you know, in an industrialized sort of setting. And one of the reasons why I love gardening, for example, and growing my own veggies and so on, is because you do get much more of a sense of that connectedness to the world. And, of course, the Gaia hypothesis is all about this, the Gaia idea that the Earth is a living being with connections throughout the physical world and the biological world.
Yes.
And we know that that's true now with what's happening with the climate, you know, the hydrosphere, the ecosphere. These things are all totally connected, and
absolutely,
we are part of it.
So absolutely.
Knock it all over sideways.
We're not the overlord.
The victims of what happens.
Yes, we're not the overlords of it all. We're like only one member of the whole family of life. You are the spirit of Rachel Carson talking right now.
Well, yeah, I certainly hope that some sort of sense prevails in New Zealand with regard to this 1080 business, because it is a devastating thing that we are doing to our ecosystem, and it's not going to be reversible. Once species like the kea, for example, become extinct, then they're gone, and they can't be brought back. I think the kea, the dramatic drop in kea numbers is almost certainly at least partly related to 1080, if not wholly related to 1080.
It would have to be.
And that's only one example of birds that are becoming extinct.
A big part of our work is to reach the people that are essentially good, but they're sort of more or less brainwashed by the propaganda, to make people aware of the techniques that are being used against them, and to increase people's basic scientific knowledge, and to get people back out truly in touch with nature, not through media, but by being there, gardening, tramping, and swimming in the ocean, and going barefooted, and looking at the stars at night, and because that's the real reality, the real world that we live in.
Yeah, and not thinking that the only way to conservation has to be killing.
No, we're obsessed with that.
Yeah, that is really a terrible obsession in this country that seems to be getting worse at the moment.
Well, would you say what's happening here in New Zealand is unique? I don't know of any other country. Whiting O'Keefe talked about this too. They go like, no other country has done anything like this except as an act of war.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel very ashamed to be a New Zealander when I see what's happening. So that's, that's why I've decided to sort of try and speak out and at least add my voice to the other voices that have been out there for a long time but have been ignored.
Well, I think what you're doing, yours is one of the clearest, most aware and informed and concise voices on all this that I've ever heard.
Oh, that's great. Well, I hope I can do something to help. Well, anyway, Jeff, I will have to go now. I've got some other things I've got to do.
Thank you.